Soikles. United States is for Fig Newton. It was named after Newton, Massachusetts.
Oh.
I haven't had a Fig Newton in a really long time.
It's because they're bad cookies.
Man, you're really downing on a lot of things that I like this morning. Jeez, don't yuck my yum.
Don't what?
Don't yuck my yum.
Got it.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin for our lunch hour edition on this beautiful, sunny Tuesday.
It is a perfect day.
It's a perfect day. And we are so excited because I think multiple times we've tackled this conversation, especially with a new proposed bill or the rumors of a new proposed bill about social media curfews for teenagers in Wisconsin and what parents should do, what the government should do, what the actual platform should do when it comes to trying to curb some of the negative aspects of social media's effects on teenagers. But now we're actually going to talk to someone who this is what she studies, and she actually talks to teenagers about it. Crazy, I know. But we're so happy to have Dr. Megan Moreno, who is the leader of the social media and adolescent research team at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, join the show. Welcome, Dr. Moreno.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. So what are the kids saying?
Well, I mean, teenagers in general, as you know, are highly individual and they have highly individual opinions. But I think one thing that we are hearing pretty consistently across adolescence is that the narrative that's been pushed forward for so long, the narrative about social media being bad, about them all being addicted, about them being glued to their phones, that narrative is really not working for them. I think that's the one thing that teens all agree on.
So that's they don't identify when they hear that as a blanket statement about them, their generation. They're like, I don't think that's true.
I think it's more that they don't find that narrative helpful because the narrative places the blame on adolescents and on flaws with them as an age group and kind of takes away their power to self-regulate and their agency when they're interacting with media. I'm always so blown away by how adolescents learn to navigate their digital environments and how much they teach each other. And that narrative really takes away that agency that they have.
And so where do you feel, does the narrative just come? Because I think there's, like, even for me, I don't have teenagers. It's been a while since I was a teenager. And so there is kind of this gap of like, how do you reach the youths? And of like, it's kind of like you base it off of like what people are saying about it and kind of like a self-fulfilling, that's probably not the right term, but like other people write about what other people are writing about and like your access to teenagers for a lot of people, unless you have them or you work with them, is just to kind of go off of what everyone else is saying. And so where did that narrative, did it come from parents? Did it come from, I don't know, like where did that narrative come from?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think that narrative probably came from when social media started. There were initially these concerns. I mean, I've been studying this since probably about 2008 when social media started. And, you know, as a pediatrician, there were a lot of concerns we had. We had concerns about strangers contacting teens. You know, that was the first big narrative of risk, is strangers are going to be friends with your teens on Facebook. And that, you know, that risk arc, kind of that discussion arced, and then we don't really talk about that so much anymore because teens are really savvy and they don't want rando strangers on their feed. So, you know, the next big risk narrative was around cyberbullying. There have been risk narratives around online solicitation of teens. And that's not to say that some teens haven't had these really terrible experiences, but most haven't. And so we've kind of gone through this shifting narrative of what the risk of the day is. And I think teens are just sort of exhausted with the pile on.
It is interesting because I would say that was like the bucket of what I hear. It's bullying, It's the fact that, you know, there's always been bullying, but you used to be able to just go home and you got a break from it versus now if it's social media, they can always contact you and yada, yada, yada. It's the potential solicitation of strangers being able to access teenagers. And then it's the combination of depression, loneliness, eating disorders, pressure to look a certain way. And so of that, are any of them still, you feel like, I mean, which of those are concerns, if any? Or is there something completely different that you think is actually more that people are missing when it comes to talking about teens and social media?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I definitely think that each of those risks are still, they still exist mm-hmm. in the universe. And there are certainly kids that have terrible experiences. But I think that if we shifted the narrative more around giving teens support and education and empowering them, I think that would go a lot further to prevent those risks, as well as acknowledging that for many teens, they're out there using these tools, trying to make things better and trying to support their friends. And a lot of those teens are supporting their friends who have had those negative interactions. But you would never know that if you, you know, read an article in The Atlantic that said smartphones have destroyed a generation.
That is, well, I mean, that was really what, like in the, was it January, February, when that big study came out, as far as like how much trouble our young girls specifically are having, and as far as suicide ideation, suicide attempts, depression. And, you know, I've talked about this. We mentioned the book. I remember reading Raising Ophelia back in like the early 2000s when I was coming of age, and like that shift that kind of happens for teenage girls and has been happening even before social media was a thing, as far as just hitting puberty and being insecure and all the stuff that kind of comes with that. But do you feel like that? Because I think when that study came out, the immediate answer was social media, phones.
Totally, totally.
And some people were like, you're missing the, are you more in the camp of like, no, you're missing, there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on and it's not as easy as just social media and phones as the culprit?
I think that's true. And that, I think in my clinical practice, that's something I hear a lot. And I've heard a couple stories from patients where they'll say, you know, their parents will bring them in and want to do a mental health screening and say, you know, I think their phone is giving them depression. And the kid will say, I'll say, what's going on? And they'll say, you know, I'm part of this climate change group at school and we're really passionate about this. We can't even get our parents to listen to us. You know, it just feels like we can't have open communication on certain issues, or they're really worried about their rights being taken away. They're worried about other people's rights being taken away. They're very plugged into what's happening in the country and the news. And when you ask them how they know that, it's through their phone. But then the unfortunate thing is then sometimes it's that the adults in their life will say, well, then we should just take away that phone.
Because that's always just take away the information. Just live and be ignorant. That is a happier way to live, which isn't, there's some merit to that argument sometimes.
Right. And I'm not saying that parents and kids have to be aligned on everything. It's a very tumultuous time. But I think that what parents can do for kids is be really open to communication and conversations about what they're seeing on social media and how do they feel about it? How are they interpreting that information? How are they processing their feelings? There's so many ways parents can teach and support teens. But I think the unfortunate, the what the news tells you to do is take that kid's phone away, stop the conversation. And I think that narrative doesn't help teens.
We're talking to Dr. Megan Moreno, who is the leader of the social media and adolescent research team at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. And I think, do you think that in general, we just don't give teens enough credit for the agency that they have, that they deserve?
I think that's true. And, you know, that's probably been true for forever, right?
Yeah.
And teenagers have been, you know, the kind of the butt of the joke for a long time. I remember reading something that someone showed me in a lecture saying, you know, teenagers today, they don't listen to their adults. They're uppity, they're snippy. They think they're funny and they're not. And we were supposed to guess where it came from. And it was an extrapolation from some carving from ancient Egypt. So we've been doing this to teens a long, long time.
That is really interesting. So I guess, what do you feel like, what are the benefits as far as what teenagers specifically get out of social media? Like, what is it actually providing them versus all the negative things that people are saying it's giving them?
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a great question. And I think one thing I'd say again is that every teenager is so individual and their own collection of downsides and upsides is going to be unique. But in general, a lot of the evidence suggests that teens get a lot of social connection through this, which I know feels a little ho-hum, but you know, if you think about the time period of quarantine and how vital those connections were for teens, if you think about how busy and overscheduled teens are, their connections via social media might be the only social connections they get outside of school. And there's also lots of evidence that suggests it can bring out teens' creativity through creating content, sharing content. And then I've seen a lot of benefit for kids who connect to other kids with similar chronic conditions or members of the LGBTQ community. For those kids, that may be the only way to find other teens like them.
That's so fascinating. I was just talking to a friend who has a disability, and she was saying, like, we can't get rid of TikTok because this is how so many of us actually connect and find humor and find connection, because it's not as easy just going out into the world. And so, well, I have, when we come back, I would love to talk more about, like, what recommendations you have to parents, to government, to the platforms themselves, as far as thinking about kids, the teenagers first, like what are some of the things that would help versus what they keep saying, quotations marks, would help. So our guest is Dr. Megan Moreno, who is the leader of the social media and adolescent research team at University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. And she will still be here when we get back. If you have any questions you want to text in, 844-967-2789. That's 844-96-PARTY. Let's all sing together. The internet is forever. Come on, you ought to know better. The internet is forever. Make it out with your professor. The internet is forever. Naked with an Irish setter. The internet is forever. Smoking in your third.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair, and we are talking to Dr. Megan Moreno, who leads the social media and adolescent research team at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. And, you know, did you have a reaction when that, I guess Utah actually did pass the bill, and it sounds like the one that's getting proposed in Wisconsin is modeled after that one. In your professional experience, do you think that is misguided, or do you think there's some parts that kind of would help, or kind of what were your initial reactions to it?
So my initial reaction to the Wisconsin proposed bill around social media was that it was really a bill that was trying to regulate the relationship between parents and their teens. Yeah. And I'm not sure that's the most effective avenue if we want long-term benefits and change. And one of the metaphors that I think about when I think about teens and social media, the idea it has risks and benefits, they're highly individual. What else is something that all teens do that has risks and benefits? it's driving a car. Mm-hmm. And we know that when cars initially came out, they were wildly unsafe. No seatbelts, no airbags. And the most effective regulation to prevent harm from driving was really the government putting pressure on the industry and making cars safer to drive. The government wasn't trying to regulate the parent-child relationship. So to me, that metaphor is helpful in thinking about some of these bills and whether they're trying to regulate the parent-child relationship or whether they're taking steps to actually make the platform safer.
That's a really good analogy. And I do, because I read that and I was like, this feels like the government's wanting to help you parent. And, you know, for maybe certain parents, like it's making it easier to have control over your kid. And I don't know, it felt weird as far as, especially coming from Republicans that talk so much often about, you know, personal responsibility. And so with what you just said, as far as the pressure went on to the industry with cars, what do you think the different platforms, be it TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, what changes could they make that you think, and maybe not even for teenagers, because there's a lot of benefits they could probably do that would be beneficial for all of us, myself included, who spends a lot of time on social media. And so what kind of regulation or pressure do you think would be helpful on the platforms?
Sure. So one of the things that we have seen evidence growing around is that it doesn't matter as much, like the old fury around screen time. Screen time doesn't matter as much. It's more the content and the experience. And so that leads me to think that if there's ways to do better in terms of what content is delivered to teens, that's probably going to be a more effective strategy. And the good news is a lot of platforms are already looking at this and thinking about how do you put some guardrails around what content is allowed to be delivered to a 13-year-old versus mm-hmm. a 19-year-old. You know, we see some effective age gating of content around alcohol, for example. If you're under 21, age gating is extremely successful at blocking youth from getting access to content. So I think putting guardrails around content is effective. And the other thing that we hear from teens that really troubles them is having control over their algorithm.
Hmm. Can you say more about that for people who don't know what that means?
Sure. So both Instagram and TikTok are very algorithm driven. And that means that the platform itself is paying attention to what you search and what you look at so that it can deliver similar content to you. Now, this was designed to keep you happy and keep you looking at that content. Chances are if you like kitty videos on Monday, you're probably still going to like cute kitty videos on Friday. But what teens describe is as they grow and as they change and their interests change, the algorithm doesn't grow with them. Or if they have a really bad period where they are, you know, really down and they're looking at more kind of down content, that content will follow them forever. So finding a way to do an algorithm reset or giving teens more power over their algorithm, I think would go a long way towards helping them have that agency that they need.
844-967-2789, 844-96-PARTY. If you ever want to comment, text her from the 715. I was surprised when my teenage son brought up the abortion issue. I then went on to ask him questions to have him think it through before he formed an opinion. Of course, I shared mine, his sister's, future daughter's rights. Social media is what stemmed that conversation, is what got that conversation going.
That's super interesting.
Right?
And so I guess, you know, we only have 2 minutes left before we have to let you go, but for parents who are listening, who have teenagers, what are kind of the blank, as we keep talking about, every kid is individual, so there is no blanket advice, but what do you tell parents typically?
So recognizing that every family is different and every family needs to recognize their own values and how they want to navigate this, the American Academy of Pediatrics does have a tool called the Family Media Plan. So you can Google AAP Family Media Plan, and that gives you an interactive tool that you can look at with your kids and make these decisions together so that you can set the rules for your household. So it gives examples, it gives ideas, but it really puts that agency on you as a parent to work with your teens on those rules. And it is a family media plan. So that means the parents have to follow the rules too, which is a really important part of role modeling.
That is, I love that. We will link that to today's show notes because that sounds like a super, super useful tool. Well, as expected, Dr. Moreno, this was super fascinating, and I'm so excited to see the continued research that you and your team are doing because it's important. And it's not only just important for teens, it's important for all of us who spend time on our phones, scrolling, and sometimes it's really useful and entertaining and provides incredible insight and information, and sometimes it just makes us feel bad about ourselves. And so thank
you. Just like offline life.
Just like offline life. Well, thank you so much for your time today. We'll have to have you back soon.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day. All right. When we come back, we are going to talk to Erin Los Cotrero, who is the founder and CEO of She Should Run. So if you've been thinking about maybe you should run, this is a sign. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Don't feel alone anymore. So go on and YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, me. That's the way to get close. Then get back to business. Please, you better not play me. Oh, come here, baby. Hope you still like me. Pay me.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair, and we are trying to get connected to Erin Los Cotrero, who is the CEO and founder of She Should Run. We can see her.
We can see her.
And I can hear her, I think. And she's going to try to call in and see if we can connect that way, because sometimes technology is technology.
It is. Do you want me to hang up on the...
And so we're going to kill time because I think she's on the phone now. But if you are unfamiliar with She Should Run, it is a nonpartisan nonprofit working to dramatically increase the number of women considering to run for public office. And so we are so excited to have her join because I have been following this organization for a long time and I'm such a fan. So welcome to the show, Erin.
I'm such a fan too. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit more for people who are unfamiliar with She Should Run of the background and history of the organization and I guess why you started it.
Yeah, sure thing. So She Should Run is a national nonpartisan organization that works to help women see their potential in elected office. So we have been operating since 2011. I'm the founder and CEO, and the work that we do is really different than what a lot of people think of for political organizations, because we're really focused on the women who aren't there yet, as opposed to the women who have already made the decision to run. It makes our work really different than like traditional political organizations.
So 2011, it's interesting because as I was saying earlier in today's show, I recently last night got to reflect on my kind of we'll call it a political awakening. And it was 2016. It was the election of Donald Trump, like a lot of women. And I think there was a lot of organizations that popped up around 2016, but 2011, that's like before a lot of people's political awakenings, I think. And so what was going on with you and your background that like in 2011 that you're like, I think we need this, which feels like kind of ahead. It's a weird thing to say, but kind of ahead of its time.
Yeah, you're definitely not alone in the world of many people that stepped into politics in 2016. And, you know, that's for another story we can talk about.
Certainly.
But, you know, the beginning of the organization was really, you know, look, I didn't come from a political background. I wasn't always in politics, but my home state's Missouri. I got caught the political bug working on a statewide race in Missouri, and then ultimately landed in DC at an organization where I was serving as the political director, helping women make a case to the big institutional players for the support that they needed, like essentially to prove their viability as candidates. And it was so frustrating to me to see all of these amazing women who were working their tails off to make their communities, make their states, make the country better, and having a really hard time. And yet the research is fascinating because when women run for office, they win at the same rate as men. It's really about how many women we can get to run. And I thought it was really interesting that there was no organization that was solely focused on finding women who aren't already thinking about it. And it seemed so obvious to me. And yet, even today, it's hard to make a case for what we do because we are like, wait, so you don't support active candidates? No, we focus on the millions of women who aren't thinking about it yet.
That is, and I love that because, well, first, I actually had no idea that women win at the same rate. Is that true of both parties?
It is true of both parties. And it's important to note, and I think our friends at one of the organizations that does a lot of research in the space, Center for American Women in Politics, will regularly say they win at the same rate in comparable races. So it's not a blanket, you know, it's when you see a similar scenario, men and women have a similar scenario, they're going to win at the same rate. It's really, women have to work harder. It's surprising because you know women have to work harder. You know women have more barriers. You know that, you know, it's a tougher uphill climb. And yet we still get there.
Mm-hmm. And yet we persevere.
And, yes, we do.
And so I guess in the, I mean, you've talked to thousands of women now and convinced them to run. What are usually their objections of why they're like, no, I don't think so. And what usually gets them to change their mind?
I was going to say, there's a long list of reasons why. We joke all the time about running a campaign of all the reasons why not, because, you know, what we see is that a lot of women, even though the reasons are varied, it often comes back to do they have the resources that they need? Do they feel like they have the resources they need? Do they feel like they have the network and the information that they need in order to be successful? More often now we're hearing, and I would say this is more in recent years, we're hearing women really struggle to see the effectiveness of political leadership. So they know they have something to give, but they're not certain that leading in politics is the way to do it. And so trying to understand whether or not essentially it's worth their time because they know how hard it will be. And so a lot of, for us, you know, we have, it's been such a kind of great journey that we're still on, by the way, and trying to understand how to effectively make that case. And it really comes down to meeting women where they are. Women are not a monolith. The reasons they do or do not want to run are varied. And you really have to kind of understand who they are, what their unique experience is in order to make that effective case.
That's really interesting. Cause I think that's certainly something that even I have felt. I was like, well, I'm like, would I be more effective doing something like that or doing the media stuff that I do? Especially because the media stuff is like way more fun and I get to say whatever I want and I don't have some party telling me what I can and cannot say. And so,
I mean, look,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I've had great conversations, especially I think it's true of some of the Gen Z women that we see stepping into the political leadership space is this. This desire, strong desire to advocate for issues that they care about, but this even stronger desire to say, you know, but that system doesn't work. Why would I try to operate within it? And I'm often in the position of making this case look like it's a both and. The system is broken. Mm-hmm. The system doesn't include women's voices, but we have to get women to the table if we want to change it. And so you can't pretend that we don't need government.
Yes.
Because we need it to operate.
That's so funny because, yes, and that is so true as far as you can't just get rid of it. It's going to be there whether or not you're part of the system or not. The system is going to be there. We're talking to Erin Los Cutraro, who is the founder and CEO of She Should Run. And so, you know, it's interesting because we recently had, and this is, we're lefty on this show, but in Wisconsin, we had a woman run for governor on the Republican ticket. And she is now, we're talking about Rebecca Clayfish, and she is now, she didn't win, she didn't move on past the primary, she's working on trying to recruit more conservative women candidates to run for different offices. And it was interesting, and we've talked about it on the show, is she kind of said, you know, women saw what happened to my family, when I was running. Mm-hmm. And I made the point on the show being like, no, we saw what happened to you. And kind of, yes. you know, I think the short end of the stick that her own party gave her. And so I use that question to, or like that setup to segue into like, what are the realities that are unique to women when they do decide to run?
Yeah. Look, I think the research is really clear on this, that the barriers that women face are very different than the experience that men have on the campaign trail. You know, it's everything from the biggest one, I would say, around women face a critical eye around qualifications in a way that men don't. And so that shows up in a lot of ways. It shows up in voters, and by the way, this is voters, you know, of all genders, questioning women in a way they don't question men mm-hmm. about whether or not they can lead, whether or not they have the experience to lead. And that is because the system, as it is known now, is built for and by men, and it's what people know and what they like it or not, or are inclined to feel comfortable with. And so when they see a woman, and especially a woman of color, run for office, it's this instinct to say, can you do it? Do you have what it takes? And while incredibly frustrating, I think the more that we can equip women to kind of know that they're going to experience it and to know that it's actually in their favor to call it out when they're being asked a question that would never be asked of men, or when their qualifications are, you know, they're really drilling down on qualifications in a way that just is very clearly setting up a double standard. You know, voters have a long way to come around on this too. So you know, just understanding the value, it's like what you can say it is important to have diversity in government, but when it's there in front of you, what is your inclination? Is it to support it or to question whether or not that a woman's able to lead?
Yeah. And I think it so often comes back to, you know, is she likable? Is she a leader? Is she a fighter? You know, these balances of your impression that you give off of people thinking that you can command a room, but also like want to have a beer with you, and like balancing those two things. And it's also, so it's fascinating to me always. I don't know if there's any other job where the skill set to get the job is very different than being good at the job once you have it.
Yes.
Like it campaigning is so different than governing.
Yes, it is. And it's this, and what a challenge too for especially the women who are serving at the highest level of office, because they're always campaigning. They, you mm-hmm. know, they win an election and they immediately have to start raising money again to run for the next election while they are also governing.
Yeah.
And that governing piece, like you said, looks so differently and requires such a different skill set in terms of, you know, constituent management and beyond. We would be in a much better place if we weren't ruled by the campaign finance system that we are right now, that's for sure.
Shakes fist violently. So before we go to break, I think kind of the elephant in the room sometimes when it comes to women's campaigns is the amount of violent threats that they ultimately deal with and the disproportionate amount of threats that they get. I've seen it on the level of Wisconsin, whether it's representatives or state senators, mayors, as far as how much more vitriol they get targeted versus men. And so how do you handle that as an objection of why someone says, I don't want to deal with this? And also, how do you handle it once people are actually running and dealing with it?
Exactly. Look, it's real first is, you know, there is this reality that women are facing threats of violence in a way that they haven't always faced. And now they're, you know, anonymous. They're coming from people who, you know, aren't willing to put their name to it on social media and beyond. And it's constant. And it's especially hard for women of color. I mean, the evidence is really clear here of, you know, where the majority of threats are going. And what we find is we this is a very real conversation that we're having. We have to address it head on and talk to women about, look, this is something that happens to women when they're running for office. And here are amazing role models in, you know, how they've dealt with it, yeah, and this sort of community that you join when you are serving in such a noble role, who are willing to embrace you and help you along the way, as you have to deal with what is just a terrible, terrible situation.
Just garbage people sometimes hide behind a keyboard.
Yeah, cowards. They're cowards.
Cowards. Yes, they're cowards. All right. Well, when
cowards
we come back, we're still going to be talking to Erin Los Cutraro, who is the founder and CEO of She Should Run. We'll talk more about actually how the organization recruits people, works on it, and what advice you have to anyone who has it in the back of their mind, maybe they would run. So stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair, and we are talking to Erin Los Cutraro, who is the founder and CEO of She Should Run, which helps to get women to run for public office, and especially women who have not run before. And so what does that process typically look like, Erin? How do you find these women? And once they say yes, what is the kind of support that the organization gives them?
Yeah, I love the question. So I also love that you mentioned getting involved in 2016, because it's sort of part of our trajectory story is what happened in 2016. So we, you know, when we got our start in 2011, we were very much in the space of doing research around the barriers that women face, and ultimately determined that if we wanted to, you know, be able to serve women who aren't thinking about running for office, we needed to create a place for them to access resources that women would need before they're ready to go. Like, when you're ready to go, you got to learn how to fundraise, you got to do the media training, you have to, you know, think about your get out the vote plan. But if you're not thinking about running for office, those things don't mean anything to you. So we built out in 2015 in anticipation of what we and most of the country thought was going to happen in the 2016 election, electing the first female president. We thought our work was going to get really hard. We wanted to launch this brand new online program just in time for that. And little did we know that, you know, with the outcome of the 2016 election, what it would mean for us, which was floodgates opened, you know, we thought we'd have 100 women in our programs. We had thousands of women within just a matter of months, and frankly spent years trying to just drink from the fire hose of, yeah, who was coming to us. And so to answer your question of what that looks like now, as opposed to women just coming to us, you know, we've had to really switch now and say, okay, how do we find the women who are fully representative of the beautiful diversity this country has to offer? We track to like the 2060 census data on this, because we know how diverse the population will be. And We are slowly becoming experts in the motivators. Like, what's going to take a woman from that place of hell no, I would never consider a run, even though she's a problem solver and, you know, in charge of all the things, she would never run for office. Okay, well, how do we get her there? And what we found is, you know, you got to meet women where they are and the issues they care most about. And that looks, that's, you know, it takes there's a lot of nuance, a lot of targeting that happens in that. But it's really about, we hands down, it's you got to meet women where they are on issues.
And what are you, I would imagine, I can kind of guess, but I would imagine childcare, paid leave are,
yes,
some of them.
Yes.
Yes. What are some of the other issues that you, the trends as far as when you're meeting women where they are, what are they already involved in?
Yes. So look, I mean, this is where I'm always careful to say, as with all things, when women aren't a monolith, yes, even on issues. But we have some great partners that have helped us. Once we determined, okay, right. And by the way, super fascinating. We found in our research that, you know, a general call around, hey, we need more women in office because, by the way, I still believe this, but because women change everything and because there aren't enough women in office, doesn't work. It doesn't work for the woman who isn't thinking about running. And so we were able to say, okay, it's about the issues, but then we partnered with people who are experts on issues. So we partnered around research with YWCA and UN Women. And so the top five issues that come up are economic issues. You mentioned some of them around, you know, paid leave and a whole host of issues around the economy. Climate, reproductive health, combating racism, gun violence is another one. I think I got them there. But those are the ones that the majority of women will cite over and over again. And they're wide issues. So, you know,
yeah,
there's a lot to work with there.
Absolutely. And so once, as far as, like, I guess just the track record of over 12 years, have you worked in, have campaigns in every single state up and down the ballot, or kind of what is the rundown of candidates you guys have worked with?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So in my history, I will tell you, I've worked with all kinds of candidates who primarily were running. When I worked back as a political director, it was primarily working with candidates running for federal office. What's fun about the work at She Should Run is we're pushing pushing hard to make a case that, look, there are over 500,000 elected offices in the country, which is crazy, by the way.
It's crazy
that there are that many offices. 99% of them are at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you want a woman to step into the space for the very first time, you know, you're often in the position of, you know, talking about an issue that she cares about, connecting the dots to what that looks like in her community. So if it's, say, it's reproductive health, okay, let's talk about if the local government is supporting access to reproductive health or not. And if you care about reproductive health, but you're not advocating for those policies, you're missing the opportunity to do more. So for us, it's about meeting those women at that very first stage. And then we push them into the greater ecosystem of organizations that work with active candidates. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. We can't work with active candidates.
Got it. Even if they're nonpartisan races?
It's really about women who are elite. Say it again.
Even if it's nonpartisan races? So like mayors, city council?
Yeah, so we can't make endorsements.
Got
it. Because for us, it's really about finding the woman and pulling her into the process and then telling her, demystifying all the amazing organizations that do exist. Like, okay, now you're running, you need support, you need money, you need to know how to, you know, build your local network, you know, through your political party.
Got it. All right. Well, we only have 2 minutes left. So what is your rallying cry knowing that, as we say again and again, women are not a monolith. It may not work on everyone, but for anyone who's listening right now, it's been in the back of their head, what do you usually tell that person?
Life is short and the opportunity is huge, and there's not enough women who are sitting at these tables where policies are being made that drastically affect our lives. And we cannot have the smartest policies if we're not in the room. So we have to get in the room, and you can do that at the local level. It doesn't have to look like the crazy turnover your whole life. You can make a tremendous difference right in your own backyard. So we often say, if you care, you're qualified. And She Should Run is a great place to get started. We'll help you get really focused on your purpose and how you get connected civically in your local community. And we'll let you know what the organizations are that can support you when you decide to run.
If you care, you're qualified. I love that. That is so true. That's half the battle sometimes, is just caring enough to show up and then taking the extra step. Well, Erin Lois Cotraro, thank you so much. This was so fun. I'm going to get your curl routine because you're even curlier than I am. But this was great. I will link everything for She Should Run to our show notes today. And you should think about it. Maybe you should run next. All right. This is As Goes Wisconsin. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.